Okay, welcome to the third review session of CS144. Should ask if there are any particular questions or topics you want to go over. Talking about the previous time. Okay, yeah, we'll go over that at the end. Anything else? All right, so this has been our third week in class, so I thought let's step back and take a look at what we've talked about so far. So let's just quickly take a minute and go over the layered model of networking. Remember, we have these four layers: application, transport, network, and link. We use the lower layers to build up the functionality at the higher layer. And so our application wants to send some data, uses the socket interface, sends that data down to the transport layer, which is TCP or UDP. TCP or UDP pack on a header, which we saw in class this week, that has, for example, the TCP has a source and destination port. It has a sequence number, an acknowledgement number, and other things that are needed for in-order reliable stream of bytes transmission. Then we use send that TCP segment over the network layer. In this class, that's IP. And that network layer is what actually handles getting the packet to the destination over multiple hops in the network. And we pack on an additional IP header, which has the source IP address and the destination IP address, onto that data and TCP or UDP header. And finally, to actually send the data one hop over a link, we encapsulate the IP packet into a link layer frame. In this class, the link layer we're going to talk about is usually Ethernet. And so we have an Ethernet header, which we haven't talked about yet, but that has a destination and source MAC address. And that's used to get the link layer frame, which has all this other stuff encapsulated inside it, including the data, which is what we originally wanted to send. We send it off, and it goes one hop, and then the process repeats. And the next router looks at the IP header, figures out where to go next, and so forth. Does anyone have any questions just about the layered model of networking?
Yeah. So for a given transmission from like one host to another, the only thing that changes is the Ethernet header. So that has to change every hop, but everything else stays the same.
Right, the Ethernet header has to change. It turns out there's some fields in the IP header, like the time to load field, that have to change as well. But yeah, conceptually, we'll go over routing today, so we'll see what happens in an IP level router. Any other questions? All right, so today we'll talk about IP, network layer. So here's some characteristics of IP. We say it's a connectionless datagram service. What does that mean? It means there's no per-flow state as opposed to a connection-oriented protocol like virtual circuit networks that we talked about last week, which is another type of network protocol where instead of just sending a packet over the network, we actually have to do some connection setup. So we have to store some state in each router's routing table about this connection before we can actually send the stream of data. In IP, that's not the case. If you send two packets to the same destination IP, it doesn't matter that the successive packets don't have any influence on each other. The packets are routed individually. They could take the same path, but they could take different paths. And since they could take different paths, they could arrive at the destination out of order. So IP doesn't make any guarantees about whether you can get there. It's unreliable. But it does say it should be best effort, so it should only be drop packets if necessary. So it's a very simple architecture. You just hand IP the packet you want to send, and it sends the packet or tries to send the packet to the destination with no connection setup at all. You just fire packets at it and tries to deliver them. It's as if you had a book and you try to send it a page at a time, and as a sender, they could arrive all out of order, or some pages of the book never arrive there, and so forth. So it's the job of the transport protocol to actually turn this unreliable service into something more reliable, if that's desired. Okay, and here's a simple diagram here. just saying that IP can operate over multiple link layer networks, and that's just transparent to the user of IP, more or less. But at least in theory, it's the link layer level stuff is just transparent. So we just send a packet. We don't care if it's going for wireless or Ethernet or FDDI or any of these, or ATM or any of these link layer protocols. All we know is we just give an IP destination address, and it gets there, or tries its best to get there. Any questions?
What are the D addresses?
Okay, so the D is data, and H is the header of this diagram. So, okay, sorry. A is the source, and B is the destination address, and these are the routers in between the two endpoints. All right, so let's talk about sending IP packets. What do we have to know to send an IP packet? Well, we have to have address it, because we have to give the source and destination nodes a name. And it's nice to, if we can group the addresses in some logical way, so that you don't have to have 4 billion entries in your routing table, so that you can aggregate the addresses in some way in routing tables. So just like the post office gives us zip codes, corresponds to our where we live, roughly. So IP addresses also have a certain structure which we'll go over. Next, we have to talk about forwarding, which is just in the IP router, determine the correct egress port for an incoming packet based on the routing table. So a packet comes in, has a certain source and destination address. We look at the destination address, compare it to some address in the routing table, and figure out what port to send it out on. And finally, we have routing, which is just determining the best route from source to destination. And the way this is actually done is by dynamically computing the routing table. So if we change the routing table, we change the path that a certain packet with a certain destination address will take. So that's how we accomplish the routing aspect of IP. It doesn't necessarily have to be a dynamic thing. You don't necessarily have to change the routing table with an algorithm. You can just change it by hand as a network operator. But we went over some dynamic algorithms for computing routing tables in class, so we'll go over that as well.
You should probably pay attention to static and dynamic routing, because lab 4 and lab 5.
Yeah.
So don't forget about it.
So any questions on this? Go over all of them a little more. All right, so let's talk about IP addresses. As you guys probably all know already, every network interface on a host has a globally unique IP address. So not every node, in other words, your computer can have more than one IP address. Each network interface card, Ethernet card, has its own IP address, except for this stuff with NAT and some other stuff that we'll talk about. Logically, every node has its a unique, globally unique IP address. And it's a 32-bit number, split into four octets. You've already seen this in your first and second assignments. And like I said, it would be good if we could aggregate the addresses in some logical way. So let's talk about the old way that IP addresses were assigned. There were five classes of networks, from class A to class E. And the way the classes were split were just based on the leading bits of the IP address. So if the most significant bit of the IP address was 0, then you were a class A network. And that meant you could have up to 2 to the 24th hosts in your network. So if you have a class A network, you could have 2 to the 24th, that's 16 million. So you could have 16 million hosts in your network. And if you didn't actually have 16 million hosts in your network, well, you just basically waste those IP addresses. They're not viewed. Class B, the first two bits are 10, so that's the range 128.0.0.0 to 191.255.255.255. You just confirm that yourself by just writing out a few binary numbers. And that has supported for up to 2 to the 16 hosts. Class C networks start with 110 and have that corresponding IP range and so forth. So you can see what happens here. If we split up the IP range from 0.0.0.0.0 to all ones, 255, 255, 255, 255. You can see that class A networks are taking up a large part of the address space, yet there's only 127 class A networks. And then there's 16K, right, because there's 2 to the 14. So there's 16,000 class B networks, and they're taking up, they take up much less of the address space, and 2 million class C networks, but they have only 256 hosts each, and so forth. So this is a very inefficient way to allocate addresses, because what if you're an organization that has maybe like 1,000 or like 10,000 networks? Well, if you think of class B address, then you'd be wasting 6,000 IP addresses, and or the bigger problem is there's only 127 class A networks. So you have class A network in your Stanford, which we did have when the internet started, and we don't have 16 million devices on our network. We basically waste millions and millions of IP addresses. So we did give back our class A network. We have class B networks now. But some schools have like Harvard, some of the class A networks. So they're just a bunch of snobs. Are there any questions about this old class role addressing policy? Yeah, this is not used anymore. This is just to give you an idea. This is always on like every networking like class slide somewhere to show you what it was before.
Because it gives a clear idea of how they were structured, so, you know, so you can use some of that access stuff. But now it's just a little more flexible, but you still have to move the levels.
So this is just to give you some historical perspective, but you should be familiar with it. If someone at least say, I'm not saying memorize these IP ranges, but you should understand what classful addressing is.
I just read up the
beginning of class B. Oh yeah, so I said we have class B networks. Well, in other words, the IP ranges were assigned to start with 1.0. They're not really called class B anymore. They're actually what we're going to cover on the next slide. So, yeah. So that was a very inefficient way to assign IP addresses. So we moved to this thing called CIDR, which is called classless, which stands for classless interdomain routing. And this lets us use variable length prefixes. Remember, if you look at the previous slide, basically the prefixes are either 8 bits long, 16 bits long, or 24 bits long. So these three fixed bits, for example, in class C, these three fixed bits in the most significant bits, 110 plus 21 bits of net ID. That's the, everybody on this class C network has the first 24 bits the same. So we would say it has a 24-bit prefix. Well, CIDR lets us have variable length prefixes. So instead of just 16 and 24, we can have basically any length prefix. So there's a few ways to write this out, but here are the most common ways. So suppose we say, talk about the network 171.64.0.0/14. So that means we're going to take an IP range that starts here and has 14 ones in the subnet mask. So in other words, if we mask all those ones and zeros here, 255, 252.0.0, and IP address, and the IP address that equals, if we mask the IP address we want to know about and the net mask, and it equals the IP address, then that IP address falls into this range. So maybe it's easier to see here. So 171.64/14 on the diagram above, you can see that defines the range 171.64.0.0 up to 255.255. So if you have a 14-bit prefix, right, then you would have 18 bits left over for all your hosts. So you can support up to 2 to the 18th hosts, which is 256,000 hosts, right? Is more flexible than the classful addressing. And you can try some lookups yourself with this Whois tool.
So maybe let's try it out.
Um,
So you can see I typed in this whois command, which looks up some database records relating to this IP address that I typed in. Turns out to be owned by Stanford University, 17164.0.1. And you can look at the CIDR range here, it's 17164.0.0/14, which is what was on the slide. And you can see who's in charge of administering this range of IP addresses and who administers them. I'm calling this everything about everything. So if you're curious, you can just run this on a few IP addresses and see who owns what on the internet. Try the other one on the slide too. So in this case, the second one on the slide, you can see that there's two networks listed, or two organizations listed. That's because the first organization owns the network, and the second organization listed, the ISP, and the second organization gets this subset of the IP range from the ISP. So if you look at this Cisco's IP range here, 17168.0.0 to 171.69, that's actually contained within this range of the ISP. So I mean, the ISP owns all these addresses, but it's you. It's leasing them out to Cisco here. And you can type in who is on this ASCII name here, netblock, Cisco block, dblock, and you can get information on this actual record if you really care to. All right, any questions? You see how the /14 and netmask are the same thing, right?
So is the /14 stored in the IP header somewhere?
So usually it's stored as netmask, which has 14 ones to the left. I mean, the first 14 most significant bits are ones and everything else is zeros, that's what I mean. So you probably, if you type in like /n in your on some Linux or Unix machine, in other words, print out the value table, of the machine, and you'll probably see a net mask specified.
Even if you're just looking at your own IP address, you put IP config or IF config, it's going to give you your subnet mask if you're looking at your own address.
So basically, if another IP and the subnet mask equals your IP and the subnet mask, then you two are on the same network. So you don't actually even have to send it out to a router. You just send it onto the Ethernet and it gets there. Because you're connected to it.
Is the netmask always ones on the X most bits?
Yeah.
So why store it as?
Why store the what?
Why store it as 4 words and not?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you usually want to, bitwise and netmask with the IP address anyway. So you.
Got it.
So otherwise, you just have to keep on regenerating this mask anyway. When you're doing operations, right? I mean, it's just a different form, so it doesn't really matter.
And but it just makes the header
longer. Right. Oh, so this is just in your local OS. You're not actually sending out the netmask. You're only sending out. So when you send an IP packet, you only have source and destination address on it.
Wait. So if it's variable length prefix, what happens if coincidentally, let's say that you send out from an IP address with 12,
Right, I see. So IP ranges can overlap, right? Like in the example I just showed you on the whois. So in that case, you have to do something called longest prefix matching to figure out who, which entry to select. We'll get into that later. All right, so some coverage on addressing. Now we have to talk about how to actually process the packet at each router, which is what forwarding is about. So how do you actually
send the packet one hop towards its destination. So here, suppose R1 gets on A's packet, does it go to the top or bottom interface, right? Because both of these routes are both of these actual routers will get it to the destination. And we resolve these conflicts by inspecting the routing table, which you can pull up using the routing protocol. The next topic. So let's take a look at a routing table inside a router. You can usually see these fields. IP address, subnet mask, gateway, which is the IP address of the next hop router, and the interface. And hopefully you see how this routing table maps to the topology below. So we have all these routers. They can have multiple incoming and outgoing links. And the router that whose routing table I've written above is displayed in the middle. So one note, I didn't write the IP addresses of the Ethernet interfaces here, but each Ethernet interface, like I said before, has its own IP address. So in this case, this router would have four IP addresses because it has four interface cards. So we run the algorithm, and we see if the so a packet comes into this router, the sender, and we look at the destination IP address, bitwise and it with the net mask, and if it equals the IP in the table, bitwise to the, with the net mask in the table for any of these rows, then the IP destination IP matches with that row in the table. And like you were saying before, this means we can have multiple matches. For example, full dot 1.1.200, well, this actually matches every single row in this table, because think about 12.1.1.200 ended with 0, that's 0, so it matches the first row. We take this and it with the second net mask, it's 12.1.0.0, and so forth, until we get to the most specific net mask, which is all 1s, and we end with this, you get back the original address, which is equal to the IP address in the fourth row. So does everyone see how this address causes a match in every row in the table? So just one note, that 0.0.0 entry is usually called a default route. We talked about in the class. So it's basically where you dump your packet if you don't know what to do with it. Any questions?
Yeah. Well, so the 0.0.0, like, doesn't a default route need to be an actual IP address though? Because you can't set something 0.0.0.0.
Yeah, so the destination address state on the packet stays the same. This is a question of just where do we send.
Okay.
The question is the next hop, which is 5.10.1.1, that's an actual IP address, right? So we're going to send it towards 5.10.1.1. Now the question you might be asking, well, not change the destination address, why do I need to know the IP address of the gateway? And we'll get into that in the router assignment. But basically, you needed to figure out how to send from the next hop. Any other questions? All right, so suppose a IP address, destination ID, matches multiple rows in the table. How do we resolve the conflict? By using this longest prefix match algorithm. It's basically what it says. If we have multiple matches, choose the entry with the longest prefix. So the largest net mask, which in this case is 255, 255, 255, 255. So that's a /32 net mask, right? So that's the longest net mask. And that's the one. So we would send that this packet that was sent to 12.1.1.200 on the E3 interface. And so you can see, just the diagram below just shows you how the IP address space is partitioned into these different ranges defined by the IP address and net mask in the routing table. And so 12.1.1.200 matches the topmost, the longest prefix. 12.1.0.20 matches the 12.1.0.0/16 range. And this other one, 128.12.92.53, doesn't match any of those more specific ranges by the ground tape, so it goes along the default route. Any questions? So we have 20 minutes, I guess, so we have 10 minutes on routing and 10 minutes on that assignment. So now that we know how to inspect the routing table and figure out which entry in the routing table to select to forward this packet on for this hop in the router, the question is, how do you build up the routing table in the first place? And the simplest way to build up the routing table is just statically, just count in the routing table by hand. Which you can do even on your own Unix box by using the route command. You can just add and delete routes. Not recommended though. But turns out one of the big features about the internet theoretically is like a bunch of nodes can go down and we're supposed to be able to route around the damage dynamically. And so the way that happens is through these routing protocols. So the first thing we talk about in class, the first routing protocol we talked about in class was a distance vector protocol, which is a distributed local routing protocol. So what does that mean? So a distance vector just contains the cost to every destination node in the network from myself, or what I think the cost is to get to every node in the network. And we also, if we want to actually do routing, we actually also need to store the next hop for every destination node in the network, which is what we did in the routing table. So the way we can get a distance vector is just by adding a cost column to the routing table, and we have a distance vector. Because the routing table tells us how to get to every node in the network, and now we just have to add this cost column, and now we have the cost to every node in the network. Any questions? So here's the algorithm. It's also called the Bell and Ford algorithm, and distributed Bell and Ford algorithm in your algorithms class. And it's really quite a simple algorithm. Basically, initially, you only know the cost to yourself, which is zero, and your neighbors, the guys you're directly connected to. So you initialize those costs that you know. Everyone else has an infinite cost. And
your slide says it has a cost to zero.
Oh, yeah, I should fix that. So everyone else has a cost of infinity. So every time we get a distance vector from a neighbor, so asynchronously, at some point, we're going to get a distance vector from our neighbor. So that means we're going to get a piece of state that tells us how much it takes to get from the neighbor to every node in the network. So if we want to use the neighbor as our next hop, then we look up the cost to get to the neighbor in our distance vector. We add it to how much it costs to get from the neighbor to every other node in the network or any other node in the network and their distance vector, and we get the cost that it takes, the cost of getting to any node in the network through our neighbor as the next hop. And if that's less than our current cost to that node, then we update our distance vector. So, right, our distance vector tells us how much we currently think it costs to get to a destination. Their distance vector tells us how much it costs to get from them to the destination. Since we know how much it costs to get from ourselves to them, we know how much it costs to get from ourselves through them, and we can update our distance vector accordingly.
So does that mean that state packet needs to contain like essentially their entire routing table?
Yeah, you basically exchange routing tables in this protocol.
Doesn't that get kind of expensive?
Right, but the question is, do you have to distribute that to the whole network or just your neighbors? And it turns out you only have to distribute this to your neighbors, right? So there's nothing here that has to propagate more than one hop. So yes, you have to send out this giant piece of state, although it doesn't actually, I mean, if you use this compression with the IP ranges and something else, it's not as bad. So you have to periodically push your distance vector. Your neighbors. So basically, you have to figure out push out your routing table to your neighbors. So basically, when you update your routing table or at some heartbeat interval, you have to send this
private data with your neighbors.
How often do you typically do that?
It's just configurable. I don't. Do you know how long our RFP uses? Like a minute?
Okay.
Five minutes.
So it's free.
Yeah, relatively. So here's a quick example. Maybe not so quick. and unfortunately, my infinity's got cut off and I'll fix that. But so what's going on here? So hopefully you can always see where I got the first column in this diagram. And so I forgot to label these things as well. So, so this is W. This first row is W. This second row is X. This third row is Y. And then fourth row is Z. So let's take a look at the top left entry. So it says the cost it takes to get from W to W is zero through W. The cost it takes to go from W to X is infinite, because there's no way for us to get to X in one hop, right? Initially we don't even know about X. So it's infinite cost, no next hop. The cost it takes to get to Y is two, right? The length on the left through Y. And the cost it takes to get to Z is 1 through Z. And you can run through all these. They're just exactly the same in this first column. So we're just looking at everyone that we're directly connected to. Now, let's just take an example, one example in this slide. You can run through the rest on your own after I fix all these letters that I didn't put up. So let's take a look at let's take a look at this entry, this bottom center entry, from which is represents how much it costs to get from Z, for example, to Y. So initially, we think that it takes a cost of 5 to get to Y through Y, right, through this direct plane. Well, now X is distance vector, now W's distance vector comes in. And it says, W says, oh, I can get to Y through Y with a cost of 2. And we know that it takes a cost of 1 to get to W, right? So 1 plus 2, so it costs 3 to get to Y through W. Does that make sense, or is it? So if you run that in every like column I wrote here, then you should get these results. Just run it through, like takes like 10 minutes, and just to give yourself an idea of what's going on. So basically, these are all routing tables, and right now I've just done it in a synchronous fashion. And when you see this error, that means everyone's exchanged their routing tables with each other, or exchanged their distance vectors with each other, and then run that simple algorithm that I just described on the previous slide, and updated your distance vectors. It turns out to settle after two rounds. All right, so we talked about this problem with distance vector, this count to infinity problem. So let's take this, just quickly take a look at this simple topology A, B, and C, right? So A thinks it's so in equilibrium, right? A, the distance vector is gonna look like this, right? I'm not gonna leave out the next hops here. Because you strictly don't actually have to transmit the next hop for this protocol to work. But so A's distance vector is going to look like this, 0, 2, and 3. So it's 3 to get from A to C, 2 to get from A to B, and 0 to get to itself. So it takes 2 to get to A, 0 to get to B, 1 to get to C. This one's just going to look. It's 3 to get to A, 2 to get to B, 0 to get to C.
1, 2, 3.
Okay. So here are the distance vectors after some sort of equilibrium. And then
Now the link between B and C goes down. So this is a really simple topology, right? You should handle this. So what actually happens? Well, C thinks, okay, I don't know how to get to B anymore. So B doesn't know how to get to C anymore, right? But now the distance vector update comes in from A. And A says, oh, I can still get to C, right, with a cost of 3. And so B says, oh, I can get to A with a cost of 2, so now I can get to C with a cost of 5. And now A sees that it was getting to C through B, which is getting to C with a cost of 5. So now when that distance vector comes in, it says, oh, okay, I need to get to C with a cost of 2 plus 5, which is 7. And you can see this just keeps ping-ponging back and forth until we get to infinity. So, in other words, B thinks A can get to C, but actually can't because A was getting to C through B. And you can end up with, if you just make cycles and longer, more elaborate topologies, basically it turns out there's no way to actually completely solve this problem. So there's these solutions called set infinity, which set infinity is some finite value, so you count up to infinity. Like in this case, you're just going to go up to infinity. Or split horizon, which means don't advertise the cost of the next hop. So in this case, A wouldn't advertise that it can get to C to B, because A was getting to C through B as the next hop. And there's Poisson inverse, which is the same thing, but advertise an infinite cost to your next hop. So these all solve the problem with this one hop, in this one hop fashion, but you can construct a more elaborate topology, which always breaks any of these partial solutions.
Why does A start sending a higher and higher value? I mean, right now, doesn't A think it can get the C with the value of 3? I mean, why would it suddenly?
Right, so the thing about the relaxation algorithm here, it says that, so it turns out in that algorithm, I should have also written, A was getting to B through C. A was getting to C through B.
Oh, so it didn't
so
know
it needs an update.
It knows where to when.
Yeah, if the next hop updates its cost.
Okay, so
then
like,
A also has
so
to
like in that table, it really is 3, and then my next hop is B. Is that kind of what it would be?
Wait, say that again.
So in that table, it would be something like currently I can get 2C through B.
Yeah, because there's a next hop I left out because I was lazy.
Okay, I got it.
And now it has to update the cost whenever this changes. And now this unit looks like this. So now whenever this changes, this has to update as well. But actually, there's no way to get to C. All right, any other questions? All right, so I actually had some slides on Deitch's algorithm, which is the link state algorithm. I won't go over it too much. You can run it through yourself. The basic idea here is just, it's not a distributed algorithm, so each router has to know about the entire network before it runs this algorithm. And so it needs to know about the edge cost of every link in the network before it runs this algorithm. And the basic idea of this algorithm is just, you start with some set of nodes where you know the shortest path, which is initially just yourself. You know how to get to yourself with zero cost. And then on each iteration, you basically relax the cost of getting from the known nodes to one of these nodes that you don't know the shortest path to. You pick the shortest path from those unknown nodes, and you add it to the set, the explored set path. So if the question's on it, come to office hours, I can run it through quickly.
Yeah,
this
problem is invisible.
Yeah. So try running through this example on your own. So let me just run through one iteration just so you have an idea of what's going on. So initially we want to figure out what's the shortest path from A to every node in this example. So initially we just know that we can get to A through with a cost of 0, and that's just ourselves. And then we know that we can add all the
nodes that you're directly connected to this port set, which is just B and D. So it takes a cost of 0, which is the cost to get to A from A, plus 2, which is the cost to get from B to A through A. And we also have to update D, which is 0 plus 9, goes through A. In the next iteration, we choose the smallest cost in this unexplored set. Right, so which is actually B, which has a cost of 2, which is less than getting to D, which has a cost of 9. We just pull out the cheapest edge here. You can see if we run this to completion, the explored set is eventually the entire graph, or all the nodes in the graph. So run this through yourself and try to make sure you have an understanding when I ask something. Well, I don't know if we'll ask you to run Dijkstra's algorithm. This is a favorite question in 244 ABC. Great. I don't know if we'll do that. But at least go through it and make sure you understand the algorithm. Because it's pretty simple. Come to office hours if you don't understand. And the proof we find in any algorithm textbook, but it's like basically proof by induction over the size of the exploit set. All right, so this is just the stuff we talked about in lecture about how to actually accomplish this link state algorithm, the Dijkstra's algorithm. And
the big difference between these two algorithms I want to point out, so it turns out the link state algorithm, we saw that the Dijkstra, the Belvin-Ford, the distance vector algorithm a few minutes ago, it can take an infinite amount of time to convert, right? You can basically end up with these ping pong effects where the cost just counts up to infinity, so it never really converges, the algorithm. It's kind of bad if you want algorithms to converge. Link state takes simple, if you have a simple implementation, O of the number of edges squared, it can be less if you use a better data structure than like an array. And in distance vector, we're propagating basically the path cost to every node in the network. So a bad path cost can infect the entire network and take it down from YouTube, went down last month. There was some Pakistani operator that screwed up the path cost to YouTube, and the whole entire internet couldn't get, or some part of the entire internet couldn't get to YouTube. Right? And a link state algorithm is much harder to do because you can only incorrectly broadcast a link cost. And the other big thing to notice in this link state or Dijkstra's algorithm, we're sending the link cost, but to every node in the network. Link cost has less propensity to cause damage than the entire path cost. Okay, so, I just want to emphasize that the link state algorithm is centralized. Like every router runs the algorithm on every node in the network, at least theoretically. And distance vector algorithm, it's distributed. Literally every router is running a little piece of the algorithm. And then when you swap the distance vectors, you're advancing in that iteration of the algorithm. If on some question you're asked, like, well, which one's the distributed algorithm, well, it's the distance vector algorithm.
If you set infinity in one of these cases to a finite number,
yeah,
how do you make sure that that's not still you? You just set the detail lower than that?
Yeah, so So clearly this is a problem, right? So RIP does is sets infinity to 16. So it actually limits the scale of the network you can administer using RIP. So clearly it's not a perfect solution. So actually you don't see RIP used very much as an internal routing protocol anymore. For that reason, you may know.
So the way you would make sure that a router doesn't take 16 as just that's the cost and that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you basically make sure your network is not that big enough so where that's a problem.
Yeah,
but that way, practice right now, they usually just use those that you mentioned. So you just make sure you don't have to test your labels. All right, so let's just talk about the lab. We might run over a few minutes here, but presumably all you want to know about the lab. So lab 3 is 2 weeks long, and I would encourage you to start early. Because it's more than twice the effort of either of the first two labs. Maybe like four times the effort.
eight times, I don't know, but it's more than twice. So spend more time or start earlier rather than later. So what is it? Basically, half duplex reliable stream of bytes. It's like half of TCP, sort of. From the client to server. So the client reads data from standard in, packetizes it into packets that are less than a packet in the transmission unit, and sends the data over the network. Network's unreliable, it can lose the packet, could reorder the packets, right? So the server has to read the data from the standard out, and there has to be buffering on both ends because of the lossiness of the network. So if packets get reordered, then the receiver must handle that, and if the packets get lost, the sender also has to handle that by retransmitting the packet after some reasonable amount of time. So you're free to pick some reasonable amount of time. Should be, you pick something, I don't know. Oh, there's a timer function that runs every 100 milliseconds, so you can use that. Here's a diagram, which I didn't finish writing. So I'll draw it on the board and I'll finish. Because it's just kind of useful to know what's going on here. So we have a client that's reading from standard in. And we need some buffer on the client, which is going to hold the packets that are waiting acknowledgments or waiting to be sent. And so we read these, read stuff from handle from standard in that gets passed to handle packet, which is a function, you'll see. And handle packet's going to start sticking stuff in this buffer. Now there's another timer function which runs every 100 milliseconds, and you can use this to handle actually sending out the packet over the network. So now you have data packets. All right, so there's an asynchronous thing in the client, right? Because handle packet is not necessarily instantly sending out the data. There's two things that can happen. You can read something in and send out the data, or you can read something in and put it into the buffer, and sometime later this timer function comes around and it actually looks at the buffer and figures out if we can send any data at all. Because we can only send out up to 4 packets that are unacknowledged at any time. That's one of the rules of this assignment. So just because you receive some stuff from standard in doesn't mean you can immediately send it out. So that's why you need this buffer here to break up the two halves of the client. All right, and then now we have the server. It's going to read the data packets that have come in. It's going to come into the handle packet function. And this is going to figure out all the other stuff, which is going to put into, might have to interact with the buffer, right, because the data could come out of order. And if the data is in order, then you can send it to standard out. And you can send an acknowledgement back to the client. This gets handled in the handle app function. And if a packet has been act, or if we've act up to some sequence number, right, that probably has to interact with the buffer as well, because you can only send out, like I said, 4 packets that are unacknowledged at any time. You have to process the acknowledgement and say, okay, this we've sent up to this sequence number already. So this sort of makes sense. It probably make more sense.
It's gonna make more sense after you
look. Yeah, look at the code and read through the documentation, and I'll update the. This slide to have this diagram just to give you an idea of the functions that are involved, or some of the functions involved in the lab. All right, some other implementation notes quickly before I let you go. So you have to find some packet header format to put in front of every one of these data acknowledgement packets. Like TCP has a header, so you have to pack on some header. Types of things you would like to need, you would like to have, are things like sequence number, acknowledgement number. You might be able to pull that into sequence number actually, because it's a half duplex connection. The type of packet is the SYN packet, ACK packet. Turns out you don't have to handle teardown,
in this assignment, so you're not actually really thin, but you maybe want to find a field for that too. And I should also say that, you know, server can handle multiple clients, basically. So you should have code that interweaves the clients or creates a new buffer, basically, new receive buffer for each of these clients. For the buffers, you can write your own linked-list library if you really want to, or some structure like that, ring buffer, I mean, whatever you want to do, right? But you might want to just use the built-in one in the OS, which is actually already used in the assignment. Or maybe it's not originally, but you can use the built-in one, which is kind of includes sys/q.h. Google for the man page of that built-in linked-list library, and you can use it. Probably the ones things that could be useful to you for building a buffer, like the tail queue or the double linked list.
So you're using UDP. They're using UDP for this.
Right, they're using UDP, but we don't give them a structure for the receive or send buffer. They have to build the structures for this. So you have to basically buffer the packets. Right, because they can get lost, and you should only remove them from the buffer once you get the acknowledgement. Or on the receive side, you should only remove them if you've got a contiguous set of packets. Right. So when you build that structure, add it to reliable.utils.h, or at least the definition of reliable.utils.h, because it's used by both sender and receiver, and Google for this man page, this linked list library that's built with the OS, at least in the most Phoenix solutions. Endianness, so that's one more thing, right? So we want to send across a sequence number that's probably an integer, or an integer, which means you have to encode it using a host network law before you put it into the packet, and you have to deserialize it using network host law on the other end. And similarly, if you use a short somewhere, you have to use these host network short. Otherwise, when we test it, we try to test it across two different architectures, like PowerPC and x86, that have different endianness, it won't work, and then it will be sad for your grid. And select and repeat or go back in. You'll be able to figure out which one of these are. So what we've talked about in class is go back in protocol, so we only send out an acknowledgement up to the last contiguous byte that we receive. You can also do a select and repeat protocol where you just acknowledge every second you get. It's up to you. And that's about it.
Is there a good way, and maybe there's not, but like to simulate like an unreliable network? Because if you're doing like this to localhost, like,
right,
it always works, it's always in order. Like,
so
there's tight for a couple days.
Yeah, we'll probably change.
Sort of yes.
Okay.
I just haven't looked into it.
Okay.
We'll probably
change it. So it turns out all your sending packets are in this code are done through the send packet function. So we'll probably just change the code so that we can put some parameter in to like randomly drop packets that you send through the send packet function, because you're supposed to use that function. There are other things you can do, like you can set up your firewall to like drop 20% of packets coming from this host or something like that. It's a little more elaborate.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. All right.
Do any of the lab machines have different Indian requests?
Yeah, but the problem here is because we're only supporting the 32-bit x86 Linux machines, they all have the same endianness. Again, we'll get into it, but just make sure you're doing this.
Yeah, because we actually look at the code, and if I don't see that, I'll take a look at it, whatever. Even if it works on the machines on campus.
All right, any other questions? All right.